This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is actor and performance artist Spalding Gray. He made his movie debut in The Killing Fields, which is about America's secret bombing of Cambodia and the bloodbath following the takeover by the Khmer Rouge. Spalding Gray plays the American ambassador's aide who leaks information to a New York Times reporter. Spalding Gray was an unfamiliar face to movie audiences and even to his fellow movie actors. But in the world of experimental theater, he was already famous for his funny and neurotically charged monologues. He's used his life as the subject of his solo theater performances since 1978. His 8 weeks filming The Killing Fields on location in Thailand provided the topic for his latest monologue, Swimming to Cambodia, which many critics have called his best yet. In it, Gray weaves together stories about the real fighting in Cambodia, the movie version of the war, his own experiences as a novice in the world of major motion pictures, and his subsequent half-hearted stabs at breaking into the entertainment mainstream. He performs his monologues seated at a table on an otherwise bare stage with a microphone, a notebook, and a glass of water. I asked Spalding Gray to begin our interview with an excerpt of his monologue, Swimming to Cambodia.
It was 110 degrees, and we were on a football field outside Bangkok. We were reenacting the evacuation of the American embassy in April of 1975. Now, the American ambassador was John Gunther Dean. And John Gunther Dean, he was now the ambassador of Thailand, and he had a lot to say about the script, and David Putnam wasn't taking any chances. Because at the time the film was being made, Costa Gravis was being sued for $14 million for missing by the Chilean ambassador, and it looked like he was going to win the case, the Chilean ambassador. So David Putnam was sending over the Killing Fields script to be analyzed by the American ambassador so that he could try to have us represent history as he remembered it. Now, Ira Huila was playing the American ambassador. Ira is an interesting man. He was vice president of Celanese Chemical for years. Then he retired, and someone saw him singing in a glee club in New York and put him in Jane Fonda's Rollover. Now at 65 years old, he's beginning his film career by playing the American ambassador in The Killing Fields. Also, small world. I think one of the advantages of living to an old age is that you see things come full circle. I get over to Bangkok, and it turns out that Ira Wheeler was on the same ship with my uncle Tinky in World War II. They were on an LST together. Now, Ira and I was the American ambassador's aide, so I was running beside Ira Wheeler. We were headed for a Cadillac limousine. It was 110 degrees. The first thing that happens when we get into the car is the air conditioner breaks. So it feels a little bit cooler outside than it is in, and we're going to be in this black torture box all day because it's going to take all day to make this one evacuation shot. The next thing that happens is the Cadillac limousine, it boils over, the radiator boils over. Then the electric windows break. Then the exhaust pipe falls off and drags on the ground. By then, I'm laughing. I can't control it. I find it all very funny. But Ira is keeping a very serious face because he's just learning how to do method acting. And Roland Jaffe, the director of The Killing Fields, has told him to look like he's on the verge of tears. So Ira has brought all of the Stanislavski books with him to Thailand. An actor prepares, building a character, and he is sitting there going into this emotional memory, looking like he's going to cry at any moment, just in case they turn the camera on him. Meanwhile, I'm getting bored, and I'm talking to the driver. He's an extra. He's an American expatriate from San Francisco. And he's come to Thailand because he says America has gone crazy, gone to the dogs. He called it gone to the wow-wows. And he believes that Thailand is the pure land, and he's come and he's working for the Thai Agricultural Committee counting elephants. Now, he goes out in the bush and he sleeps on the ground, and in the morning he gets up with his elephant counter and he goes out and counts elephants. Now, he is telling me, he's sitting in the Cadillac limousine telling me that he now has a game leg, a limp, a bum leg, and he's convinced that an elephant is going to charge him because if you frighten them and they sleep standing up, they will charge. And he thinks in a matter of months, he may be killed or stampeded by an elephant. And as he's telling me this, Ira Huila goes, "Will you stop? What effort is you're talking about? I'm trying to have an emotional memory." I say, "Ira, this guy's about to be killed by an elephant. Think on that." And we're driving through this black smoke pouring up from rubber tires that are supposed to be the flames of the war, and black smoke is everywhere, and American Marines are lined up. They're all extras, guys from America that have come over to play these Marines. I don't know who they are. Some of them are guys that couldn't get enough of the war, and they've come back to join Bo Grits and go into the Foreign Legion, into Laos to look for MIAs. Others are there to deal drugs, which is extremely lucrative but dangerous in Thailand, and others are there for basically sex, capital S, drugs, small d. And there the Marines are, and we're all lined up, headed for the non-existent Sikorsky. And the Sikorsky isn't there. Just a small chopper is there because I guess the American Air Force hasn't given a Sikorsky yet to the Thai Air Force. And we're headed for the non-existent Sikorsky. And when we get there, boom, cut. 5 months later, they find the Sikorsky. Where? Camp Pendleton, San Diego, and we all go there to finish the shot.
When you went to Cambodia, did you know that when you returned that you would end up doing a monologue about your experiences there? Did you have that in mind? Were you looking for it?
It's always in my mind when I go into an intensified situation, be it travel or when I know that something's going to be highly structured, I begin keeping a diary, a tight diary. Now, I didn't know I was going to do a monologue about the experience, but I knew that I wanted to have the choice.
Is this movie the closest you've ever come to being in the middle of a war?
Definitely. I tell you, I can remember looking back on it because I would show up, even I would come to the set when I wasn't in something. And I can remember walking into the hospital scene late, which is where all of that blood and gore and I almost fainted. Everyone was lying in these sprawl positions, and there was the most realistic blood draining down the halls, just the way that Phnom Penh Hospital was supposed to be. And I got a very strong stomach. And it hit me. I couldn't separate it. It looked real. If I had seen them setting it up, it would be one thing, but I came in the middle of it, and it was really overwhelming.
So you
the only thing that was missing was the smell.
So you were really, like, fooled by the special effects of the movie.
Yeah, it took me over. Yeah, in that scene, it did.
Do you think there were emotional differences during the shooting of the fighting sequences between the Americans like you who weren't a part of the war and the Cambodian refugees and the Vietnamese refugees who had experienced things that were actually like this and who were reenacting it for the camera?
I don't know how they did it. There were no Vietnamese there. They were all Cambodians. There must have been seven of them in all. It was Hang Noor, who was the lead, who was playing Dith Pran. And then there were other Cambodian refugees from Long Beach that were social workers that they had hired through a lot of screening. And I felt it was a very difficult time for them when they weren't smiling, and they often were smiling. It was such a vivid memory that at times they had this terrific fear and longing to be back in their country because they were so close, because Thailand was so like it. And also, because it was like a documentary, they had copied license plates for the cars, actual license plate that had been in Phnom Penh on officials' cars. And some of the Cambodians recognized those. It was a small enough country. God, seven million people. They recognized the plates. And this brought back, I think it was a very heavy time for them. And they did well to hold up under it.
You know, a lot of people ask themselves, how would I react if I was suddenly thrown into a war situation? Did you find yourself coming up with any answers to that question in the actor's war that you were in the movie war? You know, would you be noble? Would you help other people and risk your own life? Would you do the right thing? Would you be a coward?
I would probably be a coward. That's the sense that I got from it. I definitely am a Falstaff figure in that I would be a philosophical coward, an articulate coward, and entertain the troops. I'd be an underground Bob Hope.
Was there a special effects sequence that especially dazzled you when you saw how it was set up, in addition to the hospital, which you mentioned before?
All of the explosive scenes and all of the fires, it was fascinating to see for me just how they would put gas jets along buildings so the building would be burning all day long and never going down. It reminded me of a Robert Wilson piece. Much of the things remind. I can remember, for instance, there were two scenes that I was in that were cut from the film that were extraordinary scenes, my favorites. One was a New Year's Eve party that we spent two nights shooting, which finally ends with this firebomb that goes off in the streets of Thailand. We were in all of these things were shot on location. None of them were sets. This firebomb must have gone up 200 feet. We were near the largest temple, the largest wat in Thailand, on the outskirts of Bangkok. We had been up all night long. There had been this huge banquet because it was supposed to be New Year's Eve, and it ends with Auld Lang Syne and me leading a Thai orchestra playing it and me singing it drunk, and everyone's doing a dance, and all of a sudden this firebomb goes off. Well, I will never forget what a strange evening that was. It was like a Robert Wilson piece. It was like an art piece for me, being on the set and falling asleep on the ground that never got cold because it was so hot there. The ground was always warm. And there were candles burning on an artificial pond that they'd made because the American Embassy had a pond. So they dug a pond in this school, behind this school. And there was a Thai boy that would continually swim out to keep those candles perpetually lit. So the candles never burned down. So it was like a poem in the way that the theater piece is, that it was a stasis. It was constantly kept in one place. Time wasn't changing. And it, and it was fantastic. And I would look across, and there would be all these, again, like a Robert Wilson. I don't know if people know his work, but there'd be people sitting at the table in the distance, and there'd be mounds of caviar and ham and turkeys out and fruit. And when you got close to it, you realized it was rotting, you know, by the second night, you know, that no one could eat it. But at a distance, it looked like a great banquet. And then this firebomb goes off, and because they were supposed to set it off at dawn, they set it off at 4 in the morning when it was still dark. And they said, well, I guess we'll never work in this, we won't work in this location again. So they couldn't come back because they had promised the Thai police that bomb would go off at 6 o'clock, and it went off at 4. So I think that's probably part of why the scene wasn't included in the film. You know, in the kind of things that, and this was a medium budget. This is middle range. This is $20 million, which is really a medium budget film. One other thing, when we were doing the shots at the Hotel Phnom Penh, they found a beautiful hotel that looked like the Phnom Penh Hotel, a Victorian wooden hotel right on the shores of the Gulf of Siam in Hua Hin, a small town just south of Bangkok. Well, everything was right about the hotel for the location, except it didn't have a swimming pool and a tennis court. So they built them. They built a swimming pool. So all of those shots in the pool of the reporters hanging out in the Hotel Phnom Penh were in that built pool, and then they left the pool and the tennis court with that hotel, and now it has one.
There was one shot, I think, that you had to do 66 takes of, one
yes,
scene?
Yes, that was in the Hotel Phnom Penh on the steps.
Oh, so what kept going wrong that you had to do 66 takes?
It wasn't that it was wrong. There were a number of things happening. One, Roland would do a lot of takes. He was a perfectionist. The film was being sent to London to be processed, so they never saw rushes. So they had to do video replays. And what he was seeing, it was a lot of risk because all he was seeing was an instant video replay on top of the camera. None of the actors were allowed to see these video replays. We were always kept away from them. We could never see what we were doing because he wanted us to be constantly thrown off guard so it would look like a documentary, that it didn't look acted. So in the process of doing this thing with Sam, he would try to throw me off by asking me to move in another direction or say a line differently. So we were constantly changing the text to throw me off and make it look spontaneous. And each time he'd make that change, he'd also want to do a take. And of course, you've got your reverse angle. When I say 66 takes, that's including my take, reverse angle, and then us coming down the steps. So basically, it is three scenes, even though it's one in the film. And so at first I was very paranoid and thought it was my fault. And David Putnam, the producer, was there pacing around, and I thought he was angry. Because it was Roland's first feature, David Putnam had to be on set. That was part of the contract. David was always there. And afterwards, he came up to me and said, beautiful, beautiful work. You know, you've done a good job. Everyone applauded at the end. But my God, I thought it was a night shoot, and I just thought I'd be out of there in an hour. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. We finished a scene that eventually plays in the film for a minute or a minute and a half. And when I got back to New York City, I was called in to redub the entire scene because of the sound of crickets. So that's just the artifice of this, because what you're hearing finally is my voice in New York City reacting to a black and white dub print of a scene that was shot months ago on the Gulf of Siam. You know, and another example of that is Hang Noor gets back and they realize that almost everything he said in the film was, you couldn't understand it because his English wasn't that good. And they got a tutor. And she worked with him, and they redubbed in Hollywood the entire film, all of his lines, in 3 days. So everything you hear in that film is him speaking it in Hollywood, looking at an image, a dub image, where you watch the line go across, and then you start speaking as soon as it hits the... So I think that kind of thing is fascinating. The real elements of the film, particularly me, a performer who works right in the moment with the audience. I'm not mediated in any way.
Let me ask you, from your monologue, I get the impression that one of the pastimes in off hours was smoking Thai marijuana.
Some people did that, yeah.
And I get the impression from you that it makes you paranoid when you smoke it. So I guess my question is, why did you smoke?
I'm fascinated by psychotic states, and have been for years. My mother had a very severe nervous breakdown and eventually committed suicide in 1967 after a two-year period. And not just because of that, but I've always been interested in abnormal psychology, and I guess it's something that I would do in another lifetime. I'd be interested in going into being a therapist. And I know that sometimes I get bored with health. with life as it is. It gets flat. And I often think that the marijuana is a perfect way to break through and go into that other realm. And then it's then afterwards I always repent and say, now why did I want to do that? But within that, sometimes there's a number of very wonderful experiences happen in the sense of being able to let go with the perfect moment that I describe in the Indian Ocean, where I am not holding on to anything and I'm able to open up and feel this terrific at oneness. So it can go sometimes either way. In that way, it was healthy and I was outdoors. But usually it is a kind of grinding paranoia that keeps me awake. And certainly I really understand my personal paranoid state and am tired of it and bored of it. I'd rather go on to other things. And that's why I like Swimming to Cambodia as a monologue. I think it's the first monologue that has transcended the personal neurosis, because it is, God, it's so involved with that other world condition that is so much bigger. It's very humbling, you know, I don't get as involved, dwell so much on personal neurosis when I think about that Cambodian genocide.
How did that whole experience of being in the killing fields change you politically, if at all? Because you describe yourself as someone who doesn't really vote, who isn't politically involved, and here you were in the middle of a movie about politics and war.
Yeah. Oh, boy. I'd say two things happen. One is that I have never been able to read newspapers, reportage. I'm more interested in what I call poetic news, Joan Didion, some sort of filter system where there's a personal slant on the news. And I find now that I'm very able to read about Southeast Asia because I now have an in. And I realize how important that is, that probably most people that read about El Salvador and Nicaragua just don't know the difference between the two countries and what the standard. And even I haven't caught up with that. I'm still following any press, and there's so much of it now, on Vietnam, what's happening on the border, what's happening with the fighting. And I find that I'm able to pick up an article and read it with some understanding because of this film. And that has given me a crack into the world. We could call it a political one. I still feel the political is the personal. But this is a personal, I have had that personal experience with that film. And that's one thing it did. The other thing it did was certainly got me in shape to vote for the first time in my life this year. And I had been swearing I was going to sign up, and I was putting it off, and I was doing Interviewing the Audience, which is a favorite piece of mine where I interview my audience, and I was doing it in Woodstock, New York last summer, and I was interviewing a woman who was doing voter registration, and she signed me up on stage right there. She registered me to vote on stage, so it was perfect. It all came together in a performance piece.
Well, now that you've had the experience of being in a major motion picture, do you want to go back to the art scene?
That's a good question. So I've spent 2 months out in Hollywood, and I have a film agent I got an agent because I was in the killing fields, and I thought I should give it a try. They sent me up for lots of things. None of the things I felt I was right for, none of the things I was interested in. It was mainly television. And my agent says, you know what? You've got to take your savings and come out and live in Hollywood for 2 years, and we can give you a career. We can make a career for you. But you've got to be prepared to wait and hang out. I haven't waited in years. If I went to Hollywood to wait to make a film, I would make a monologue about waiting to make a film.
Didn't you audition for that TV series Hail to the Chief, in which
Patty Duke
plays the president?
Yes, that's definitely part of the monologue. I was the dark horse from the East. I can't believe they brought me out there. I get out there. They put me up in the Beverly Hilton. They want me to play Patty Duke's husband. She's the first president, and Hail to the Chief. Now, the only person, they boil it down to me and Dick Shawn. There's two of us. And I can't believe this. I'm very nervous, and I haven't memorized my lines. I should have. I didn't work real hard on it. Dick Shawn's got his lines down. So they're rushing us in like the bullfights, and we have to come in front of all the producers are sitting there in the dark, and you have to come out in this arena in front of them, and they're sitting in these big leather chairs judging you with it. And so they rushed me down. They thought I was on next, and I got there early and had to sit outside the room and hear Dick Shawn doing his thing, and nothing could be worse. First of all, everyone was laughing. Second of all, he had memorized his lines. Thirdly, he knew Patty Duke and was able to put his arm around her, and I came in, I hadn't memorized my lines, I was so stiff, I felt like a Kennedy, you know, I mean, with my New England accent, and I thought, well, if they want to go that way, fine. I remember putting my arm around Patty Duke and feeling my arm was made of plastic, you know, and yet in my monologues, I'm very free, which made me believe I was not ready to make the jump. chump, that somewhere in me I was, you know, Dick Shawn was ready. He was there. Hey, he was there for the work. He got it. Actually, he didn't get the, he got another role in the CIA agent or something. But the point is that when I'm really in a space and I know my material and I trust the people, I can be wholly present there. But if I were to get that job and I would have to sign a 6-year contract, it's not that I'm holding back from that. I would like to be accepted, but I realize I'm pretty esoteric. I was screened 2 hours for the Johnny Carson show. That was an interesting session by one of Johnny's representatives, you know. And I realized that I a lot of my material is really just too much for the average American audience.
They screened you for the Carson show, but they didn't let you on?
Well, he loved my stuff, the representative, and but he wanted to make it lighter. He said, you've got to realize we are playing for a lot of, I don't think he said stupid people, but he said a lot of not very intelligent people who want basically to go to sleep. Now, he knew what he was talking about when he said this, and he said, you can't tell, you don't, I told a story about how I was making my first sensual girlfriend at college. We would make love in front of the fireplace, and I was too cheap to buy firewood. And I was in Moliere's Misanthrope in college. I played the lead. And afterwards, I had them bring down the set, tear the set apart, and throw it in the corner of the apartment, and we would make love in front of the burning Moliere set. And when we ran out of Moliere set, we broke up. And he said, oh, that's a wonderful story, wonderful, but don't say Moliere. Johnny doesn't like theater, and also don't confuse the audience. I say, what am I going to say? Because I like to name names. Shall I say Under the Yum Yum Tree? What'll I do? He said, listen, I tell you what you should do. I love you. I think you should be on Dick Cavett. I said, oh, I'd love to be. And he said, don't you know Dick Cavett hasn't been on for 2 years? I said, no, I didn't know that. He goes, I love you. You didn't know that. I love you. So he said, well, listen, I'll tell you what you do. Do you have a TV? No. I don't have one. So I rented a TV in Hollywood to watch Johnny Carson for a week to see. He made me promise that I'd watch him for homework to see where I would fit in. Then he called me back. They really wanted me to come on. And he said, can you give 5 questions that Johnny can ask you? Because he's got to be on top of the material. He's got to know what he's asking you. This is rehearsed. And it's got to be quick. We don't want you to perform. We just want you to talk. And I said, God, try to think of 5 questions. And I said, how about 1? How is this night different than any other? And from there, that was the end of it. He didn't laugh. He was Italian.
When you were making the rounds of the TV casting calls, did you imagine what life was going to be like? Had you, like, accepted the position of being Patty Duke's husband on Hail to the Chief?
I saw, strangely enough, a life of peace. I know it's ludicrous, but somehow I thought I would close Pandora's box and that I just would try to live a simple life. And I give a really exact description of that in Swim to Cambodia Part 2, where my girlfriend Renee and I, we would get married and we would have this Hollywood home that was fairly humble in one of the canyons. And I would go off to work and I would do the show and would come home and we'd... have children. It got kind of creepy when I really looked at it because it was missing in any kind of conflict and imagination and spice. And it got real flat. It got real flat. And it was real. If I really examined it, it was pretty. It just wasn't me.
You play yourself when you're doing a monologue.
Aspects of myself.
Yeah, right. And your experience is really transformed in it. It's not a literal rendering of what happened.
Right.
But when you're in real life, do you ever feel like you're playing yourself too?
I will play often with Renee. I will do it where I'll act depressed. When I'm mildly depressed, it's as though I'm one of those people that makes histrionics to avoid anxiety. Because when the anxiety is inarticulatable, then you make up a new histrionic anxiety to cover the one that you're not really getting to. And it's an overlay of histrionics there that has become a performance for me. It could go the other way and try to cut that away and go into therapy. At this point in my life, I think I've made a career of it and wouldn't be interested in doing that. But I remember I have a monologue called A Personal History of the American Theater. And in it, I say, you know, some people are born people. They're just born people, and they make a decision to become a lawyer or a doctor or an actor, and they go to school and they study it, and they're professional. For others, it's an ontological state. I was one. I hate to admit this, I say in the monologue, but I saw life as a flat thing, and I would theatricalize it by taking cues from the outside world. I'll give you an example. It's 4th of July. I'm a young kid, and I hear a few fireworks go off. Boop, 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 boop. And I rush to the window and go, Mom! Mom, come quickly! Rush Jaman, our neighbor, is up on his roof shooting his kids. And this was before that happened a lot, you know? know, in the old days before it really happened a lot. And my mother would rush to the window, believe in me for a moment, you know. I would draw Hurrian onto it, and she'd go, oh, Spuddy dear, don't. You know, why? You know, why do you have to do that? So right from an early age, I was theatricalizing my life for whatever reason. And finally it turned into performance art. And what I was really doing was autobiographic work. I wasn't so interested in studying a character and doing that. And I remember my first experience of autobiographic theater was the first play I was in called A Curious Savage in boarding school, where I had to make took place in an insane asylum. I thought I was Hannibal. I was supposed to have delusions of grandeur, and I thought I could play the violin, and I was just sawing at it. And I started to do this downstage left cross, and there was a carpet on the floor that wasn't there for rehearsal, and it had squares on it. And I just did this improvised hopscotch in character or out of character, whatever. I hopscotched across the rug. And the audience went wild. And right then I realized the terrific power of the initiation, that I had created a performance piece within that overall play. And then it was years after that before I thought of lifting the hopscotch out of the context of other people's scripts and becoming an autobiographic performer. You know, it was a long evolution. But I look back on that as one of the original, not that everyone improvises, they all improvise, but they try to put it as a gestalt with the text. I finally began to want to bring that out and make it my own.
You know what? I haven't asked you if you like The Killing Fields.
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. I saw it twice. The first time I saw it, it was like a home movie. The second time I saw it, it was much more moving, and I got involved with it more as a representational story. The first time I just saw it, of remembering. I cried when I saw it first, not because of the story, but because the opening scene showed Bangkok with the monks, and I cried out of the nostalgia of the experience. You know, of making the film rather than what the subject of the film was about. And the second time I got much more into it, particularly the jungle sequences toward the end. They are so extraordinarily beautiful and just wild. I think it's a wonderful and noble project, but I still lean toward The Deer Hunter because I think that it got more involved with the particular personalities of the people. And in The Killing Fields, it's more of a documentary wash. And because this was a British experience, this film was essentially a British film and produced by Brits and directed. And it's also their view of it. And I still feel distant from it. I'm still an American. And for me, The Deer Hunter was the real view.
One more short thing. Do you think that your audience is really glad that you left for this major motion picture and you've come back to them now, here?
Yeah, it's kind of an embracing. We're happy to have you back. I think that's operating, and I hope it is. I hope it is.
That was actor and performance artist Spalding Gray, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The technical directors for today's show were Mark Moss and Jay Goldman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.